Well, for those who are connected to the Gregorian calendar, Happy New Year. And if you're not, because the Orthodox, Ethiopian Orthodox have a Happy New Year in September, and others believe the New Year is in March or April. But that said, I want to conventionally welcome you to our first Sunday sit for the year. And as is customary, a significant part of the talk and introducing the talk will have an opportunity for us to take the precepts and the refuges together. And certainly at the beginning of a new year, it's important to ask aspirational questions. What do we want to improve? And what do we hope will change? But the Buddha has something far more exacting, which was, what courses are we willing to establish again and again through body, speech, and mind? And the question is not poetic, it is structural. Because the Buddha understood long before neuroscience and psychology or systems theory that suffering does not end through intention, insight, or inspiration alone. It ends through conditions wisely cultivated. And when the causes of suffering are present, suffering follows. When the causes of freedom are established, freedom follows. You see? So this is a bit of an exhortation before we take the refuges together, the precepts, and getting into why we're here. So before we analyze the world, which we will have an opportunity to do over the next 26 minutes, before we speak about dukkha, we do exactly what the Buddha always did first. And we're going to take the precepts together, as well as the refuges. And in the chat, I have put in the words to the precepts and the refuges. And if you're inclined, you can chant along with us audibly or silently, whatever is your inclination. And I'll start with the exhortation, just a short exhortation before we get into the collective sharing of the precepts and the refuges together. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammam sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammam sambuddhassa. Together. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam
Dhammam
Saranam Gacchami, Sangham
Gacchami,
Saranam Gacchami,
Buddha
Dutiyampi
Saranam
Buddham
Gacchami,
Saranam Gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Panatipata Weramani Sikapadam samadhiyami, Adinadana Weramani Sikapadam samadhiyami. Kame su michachara veravani sika padam samadhiyami. Musavada veramani sika padam samadhiyami. Surarameya maja panadatana veramani sika padam samadhiyami. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So, as I mentioned earlier, the talk is going to be focused on beginning the year in refuge, in integrity and embodied truth as a path to liberation. And just before we began the session today, about 10 minutes before we opened, when people were trooping in, and I was listening to the conversations, certainly no one is unaware of the current state of the planet we live in. And so because of this particular condition, I want to do something a little atypical, but that's what we do. And I want to read the lyrics from a very powerful song. The song is titled War. War. And it goes like this. Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned, everywhere is war. Me say war. That until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man or woman or person's skin, I added that, is of no more significance than the color of their eyes, me say war. That until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all, without regard to race, dis a war. That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rules of international morality, remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. War in the East. War in the West. War up North. War down South. War. War. Rumors of war. And until that day, we will not know peace. And we will fight and do what is necessary because we are confident in the victory of good over evil. Good over evil, yeah. Good over evil. Good over evil, yeah. Good over evil. Good over evil, yeah. Bob Marley. Bob Nesta Marley. And this is based on a speech that was given at the United Nations by Emperor Haile Selassie. So now that we've established this, not symbolically, but in an embodied way, today what I want to focus on a bit is why dukkha has intensified 3-4 days into the new year, what we know about contemporary evidence about what's happening, what the Buddha and other great spiritual masters in our tradition said about embodiment, how the refugees and the Four Noble Truths and even dependent transcendental origination function causally, not philosophically, and how liberation unfolds through transcendental dependent origination, which is the theme for the year. So the Buddha never framed suffering as a personal failure. The Buddha framed it as a causal effect to conditions. And in 2026, there are many causal conditions. I'll go through three or four of them. The first is mental health at scale. Global public health data shows that anxiety, depression, trauma-related disorders, and stress-induced somatic illnesses now affect hundreds of millions of people worldwide. So onset ages continue to decline, and this reflects a chronic exposure to uncertainty. Although uncertainty is a fact of life, but we're speaking to the conventional mind. Loss of agency, and this consistent feeling of being under threat or threat perception. So if you're consistently under threat, from a neuroscientific perspective, what it activates is the amygdala. That's where fear lives. And if your amygdala is activated, what opportunity do you have to be mindful? For the public health professionals and medical doctors here, you know what I'm saying? And I know there's a medical doctor or two here. In the Buddha's language, this is dukkha born of unrelenting contact, fasa, and craving, tana. So that's the first factor, mental health. The second is a nervous system overload. Nervous system overload. From a neuroscientific perspective, it shows that prolonged feelings of economic precarity or climate anxiety, political polarization. I say we're in a period of peak hate, peak hate, peak hate, digital overstimulation. All of these keep the nervous system chronically activated. Chronically activated. There's some therapists and mental health folks here. You know this is true. I'm giving you the evidence because I always like to balance the Dharma with science, although the Dharma is meta-science. So when the amygdala, the fear center, dominates, the prefrontal cortex for rational thinking is compromised. So the impulse control weakens. Ethical restraint degrades, and there's a sustained attention collapse. Hence, adult ADHD, and I'm using it as a metaphor, not as a medical diagnosis. The Buddha described this phenomenologically as the uncollected mind, asamahita citta. The uncollected mind, Suze. The third factor, loneliness and social fragmentation, Rebecca. Large-scale surveys show that 1/4 of adults report frequent loneliness. Now, that's different if you choose solitude. I choose solitude. I've been divorced twice. See? But loneliness. And loneliness is strongly correlated with depression. Cardiovascular disease, Janelle. Cognitive decline and mortality. I'm not saying this to entertain you. I'm giving you the information. This makes the Dharma even more urgent for me, for I and I. Then this leads to addiction and numbing. So both chemical substances and digital platforms increasingly function as socially sanctioned anesthetics. Neuroscience confirms that these reduce your interoceptive awareness and executive function. directly undermining mindfulness and the fifth precept. This is not moral weakness. It's cause and effect. This is what we are all under. Every one of us. Everybody. If you're breathing, I'm talking to you. Whether you're breathing on your own or it's assisted. If you're, because you're a sentient being like I. Or like the otters that I like to watch. I'm addicted to watching videos of otters and baby elephants. Right? Who knew? Then there's a collapse, the fifth factor, the collapse of truthful speech, Julie. Research consistently shows that sustained deception, whether it's personal or systematic, so whether you're doing it to yourself or you're doing it interpersonally, or it's coming from outside factors, increases cognitive overload. Can't do it. Stress hormones and internal fragmentation. That's why after years of not having boundaries, I have very strict boundaries now. I had to learn. The Buddha taught us that false speech fractures the mind. So even more time for direct embodiment, because the Buddha did not teach awakening away from the body. The awakening happens in this avatar that is sustained by this breath. Specifically, the Buddha said in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya 10, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly knowing, and mindful. Body in the body means staying with sensations, like we did during our sit, staying with the breath, if you can do that, or with your hearing, or whatever sense door grounds you the best, because we're all unique and different, yet the same. Staying with reactivity. I used to be very reactionary. Now I don't, for the most part. I had to learn the hard way to become more responsive or irresponsive, which is a response. Staying with pain and pleasure as they arise, because liberation occurs where suffering is felt, not where it's bypassed. So I was having a conversation with Tori Sala about suffering. And she said very clearly, even the devas suffer. They deal with dukkha. That's why they always came to the Buddha to have conversations. Too much pleasure, I can't do it. So suffering, in my interpretation, is not bad. Because let's go to the law of physics for a moment. Are there any physicists here? Polarity is what keeps the world in balance. That's why in the Tao we've got wholesome, unwholesome, neither. Balance. How can there be light without darkness? There's no utility for light without darkness. What's the point of light if there's always light? It is darkness that makes light possible. It is suffering, unless there's a spontaneous awakening, which can happen, that makes Nibbana, awakening, the citta mind, the bodhisattva, possible. The deeper the suffering, the higher the ascent. The deeper the descent into ego death, I'm using some secular words here, to the dark night of the soul, the higher the ascent. In fact, and I like to quote the Burmese teachers quite a bit, particularly Mahasi Sayadaw. What Mahasi Sayadaw said about this is, insight arises only through direct observation of phenomena as they actually occur in the body and mind, moment by moment. Lady Sayadaw said, sila is the root of samadhi, focus. Samadhi is the root of paya, wisdom. Without the roots, the tree cannot stand. So embodiment means disciplined intimacy with reality, not emotional indulgence or conceptual spirituality, especially after what we've all seen this weekend. Now, how does this all connect to the theme for the year, transcendental dependent origination, as we wind down the last 5 minutes? It begins with dukkha. So when dukkha is fully acknowledged, that awakens faith. Because where else is there to go when you've hit rock bottom of dukkha? I've been there so many times, more times than I care to count, in many different ways, like you. But faith arises. This is a confidence knowing that suffering is intelligible. Whatever your suffering is, faith. Faith, faith. That brings joy, Linda. Because I know there's a path. So when I'm joyful, how can I be afraid if I practice joy in the same way I've practiced fear? Laura, I'm looking at you. And that joy brings tranquility, Candace. Something you embody well, Candace. Tranquility. That's a nervous system settle because you know suffering. And with tranquility, you can be concentrated. That's stability without force. And from concentration, you begin to see clearly this whole cosmic game. Judith, I'm making a reference to your Sufi people here. This cosmic joke. And that brings you to disenchantment. I've seen some TikTok videos on what's going on and I pay attention and then it doesn't connect anymore. It just doesn't. But I'm not bypassing, I'm aware. That disenchantment with what works in the third dimension doesn't resonate, although I live in the third dimension. So that leads to a weakening for your compulsions, for your attachments. And when your attachments are weakened, and I've weakened my attachments, I had to let go of my father, my mother, two wives, my siblings, old jobs, friends, places, things, even the way I look. That ultimately leads to vimutti, unbinding, liberation. And of course, we have to sustain this because there's many things to overcome. Many things in the conditioned mind. This is consistent with what Buddhist psychology, particularly the Visuddhimagga, references as the seven purifications, right? It all leads to ethical purity, which culminates in freedom, sila. And so the Buddha, obviously, the Dharma is, as the Bodhisattva vow says, the Dharmas are inexhaustible. I vow to master them. And to do that, the Buddha gave a simple framework. Are there any organizational development experts here? The first is pariyatti, study. Just like we have the refuges, pariyatti, study. And when you study, patipati, practice what you study. We're talking about embodiment here, which is available to everyone. I also know that there are some arahants here, so bear with me and thank you for your grace and patience. And it leads to pativeda, realization, study, practice, realize, SPR, study, practice, realize. Don't just study, 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 or practice, 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 practice. You won't realize. So the exhortation is, let's study the refuges and the precepts until they are felt. not just hear, but felt. 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 You know, there's an organization in California called the Heart Math Institute. They have MRI machines that measure heart waves. The heart emits a frequency that's 5,000 times the heart, 5,000 times more potent than this. Hence, follow the heart. Trust your gut. So whether the Tathagatas arise or not, phenomena stands. We've taken the refuges together three times. We've shared the precepts. And in this time of great dukkha, even the devas experience dukkha, too much pleasure. To me, dukkha, the deeper the dukkha, the higher the ascent. I would not be sitting here with you today without all the dukkha I've had in my life for almost 5 decades. I know I'm a kid to some of you. I know, 5 decades. What's he talking about? Look at this little thing. Suze, I'm talking to you. So in conclusion, and we're not going to go into breakout groups. We're just opening up for discussion. May this year be one of embodied integrity, especially when integrity out there is questionable. May this be a year of deep understanding, especially when the world is committed to misunderstanding. And may this lead us to irreversible freedom. Not as Pollyanna. No, I'm not being Pollyanna-ish at all. There's significant evidence from history, from folklore, from myth, of ordinary people who found the spark in them, despite the suffering they experienced. You see. As we move into our discussion, I want to emphasize that let's keep it non-judgmental. Let's keep it respectful, even if you disagree with everything I said or disagree with what someone else says, because we are the counterbalance to what's happening out there. So may we begin to embody that together with each other today. Yes. So thank you for the time and attention. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Suze, go for it, please.
Beautiful, wonderful talk. I'm just filled. I love Dharma. My question has to do with the words you said about disenchantment, dispassion. And I think I heard this right. I'd love for you to talk more about it. That certain aspects of life you cease to resonate with. And is that how you're describing dispassion or disenchantment? I don't know the difference between them. Could you speak a little bit more to that?
Yes, it's really what I'm pointing to. So this is a great question, is detachment. I'll give you an example, a couple of examples. I used to enjoy going to concerts a lot. You know, I did. And they got to a point where I'd go to a concert. It doesn't matter who, how famous or how amazing it was. And after 3 songs, I'm ready to leave. Because it didn't feel the same. But it's also sensitive to the energies around me. So then I realized that something I used to do is not something I love doing anymore. In fact, I prefer to go to the beach, Gordon Gardens Beach, and talk to the ocean. Because what does that do for me? Brings me closer to the Dharma, to the not self. Another example I'll give you is when I was first divorced, I think this dovetails to a subject you want to teach, you're teaching about. Is initially I was like, oh, this is great freedom. I'm going to date and check out my options. And pretty soon I'll be on a date and I'm like, I'd rather be by myself or listening to music or at the museum. I don't want to do this. I'm not. You see, so I became disenchanted with that seeking outside of me and more enchanted with seeking what's inside of me. But I have an excuse, twice divorced, right? So that's that disenchantment there. Some practical examples. I don't know if it answers the question, but I tried.
You did great. And I think it's a really powerful topic. So come fall, when we're going to look at disenchantment and disfashion. Because there's also right next to it the joy of being alive and everything that comes in through our sense doors is so incredible, you know, that we've been given this life embodied as humans, which is hard and wonderful. So it that tension there. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Laura, please go for it.
Thank you so much. It's a very evocative question. You know, one thing I'm thinking is disenchantment has a sort of negative quality to it, right? Maybe another way, maybe another word is reorientation, or, you know, or and a newly acquired sensibility. I don't know. Those are words that come to me. Yeah, I was looking for you. Those are right. A shift in consciousness. I mean, these kinds of things come more. And so it's not. You could even use the word re-enchantment, because we go through so many layers of disenchantment as we go through life, right? And until right we get to that disenchantment, but then. At the same time, right, that the disenchantment is there, there's also this whole process, right, that's been going on, right, also. It's kind of both, yeah, both.
It is. You're absolutely right, Laura. It is. It is. And it's almost like nobody can come to you and tell you you're not a stream enterer or an arahant. You know. And we know based on your embodiment of it. And in that embodiment, you may say, oh, Laura, or we feel the energy when we're next to you. You don't have to say I'm an arahant or a bodhicitta or a bodhisattva. Similarly, with what you just described, I think it's the same thing. Who's going to come tell you? Because we've got the Dharma. The Buddha told us. The Dharma tells us. And if we've got wonderful Kalyanamitas in the Sangha, they tell us too. Or they embody it and we see it. And so what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, and what is neither? And in my practice, it always comes back to the Noble Eightfold Path, right? The Noble Eightfold. So my disenchantment with going to concerts was replaced with a wholesome enchantment with the ocean, or Discovery Park, the water holes of Discovery Park with a very energetic way. Right? This is what I thought I heard you say, Lauren. Yeah. Faith, and then Lauren, please.
One thing I've been thinking about lately that you addressed is this feeling of absolute overwhelm, the anxiety that seems so rampant, and a lot of it is because we're hearing so much about what's going on. But one thing that has always helped me, I was an anthropology major in college, and is knowing that we always think that our society or our family or whatever is unique, and that suffering is so universal. And we just know, we just are hit with a fire hose of information about it on a worldwide basis. But it's always been happening worldwide, and people have been suffering from war, disease, grief of all kinds, and anxiety of all kinds. And that somehow, that gives me a strange feeling of peace, because there's nothing special here. It is part of the human condition. And I really felt like you addressed that from several different angles. And I appreciate that. And so I guess I don't have a question. I wanted to just say that. Well, thank you for listening.
Well, thank you, Faith, and thank you for laughing at my joke on the faith part. Yes, I heard everything you said, and what I retort to your commentary there is, so I gave a talk a number of months ago in Portland, and one of the things I wanted to understand was, deeply understand, was the social, economic, and political factors that existed at the time of the Buddha, you know, beyond his sort of being in the wonderful palace. What were the social, economic, political, even technological conditions there? And I found out a few things. So the reason why the Buddha, or even the Dharma, has a sort of egalitarian, I think the Tibetans may be a little, the Vajrayanas may be a little different, but generally egalitarian, right, approach to understanding the Dharma is because of what existed at the time, the Brahmanism, which promoted social stratification. And there was no mobility. It's just like being in the UK, there's no mobility there. So that, supported by Brahmanism, is like, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. Then you think about this exhortation, the fifth precept, not to take drugs or alcohol that cloud judgment. There's this corn-based alcoholic drink that the lower classes would abuse on end. So that's where that comes from, right? That's where then the precept not to kill came from all the wars and the kingdoms that existed in Lumbini and other areas. Intense warfare, really, really intense warfare. And you know, when you are in the soldier class, I think that's the third or the fifth social caste, right? So it's just like you think about the British Empire, the soldiers who went to colonize were the folks who could not be gentility in the UK and own land. So they went overseas to India and Kenya, the landowners all of a sudden, and gentlemen and gentlewomen, right? That's how it works. So that was another condition there. And then the introduction of coins was a novelty. And think about what we have now with cryptocurrency or this digital currency. So you're absolutely correct that the flavor of hate has always been present, right? The flavor and the technology of perpetrating hate might be a little different, but it's rooted in wrong view and wrong intention. Wrong view, wrong intention. So that's my exhortation, my commentary to your comment. Yes, yes. Lauren, please, Judith.
Yes, I wanted to go back to disenchantment and joy. And I have been prone to enchantment in my life. And I love disenchantment because I've seen how it poisons and leads to disillusion, to illusion. And the bare knowing of Buddhism to me is really important. And it is an inward turning, you know, the knowing. So I have, just added so many layers to events and things that I care about and things that I want to happen. And then I've seen that I built up this thing as an enchantment. And I thought it would have joy, you know, like I built layers of how it was going to bring this joy. And then seeing through it, I just kept one time after another seeing through it, oh, this is not where joy is, and that there still is joy, but it's not with those layers. So that's the way I see disenchantment, that it's really important to notice when I'm doing that. And then I think Seuss was saying disenchantment and dispassion, which to me, the dispassion is equanimity and the adding to preferences, you know, and this is what I like, this is what I don't like. But joy is different. Joy is way more peaceful, way more peaceful. And joy still is there. But yeah, to separate joy and enchantment, that has been really an ongoing process for me. So I just wanted to come back to that because it's really important in following the path for me. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really profound what you've described. There's joy. And joy based on what? Why are you happy? Did you win the lottery? Did you get a promotion? Did your stock portfolio do well? Are you going on a vacation? Then you're joyful. Right? But I think what you're pointing to is a joy that comes from observation of the Dharma and the Dharma in you. So if somebody comes to you and says, you're not this, and there's no reaction, and then you see how that changes the other person's ignorance to awareness, there is joy in that. Because again, and I've been practicing with the Bodhisattva vow, but that's Mahayana. The first says, sentient beings are innumerable. I vow to save them all.
Yeah, deeply we want that kind of joy and discerning the difference between happiness and happiness is really important.
You said it, and I'd reference a Dharma-adjacent teacher. He was in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, but I believe, because his picture is in the Gratitude Heart at Spirit Rock, this teacher, Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. So this quote he would often say is, no matter what happens, I don't mind. I don't mind. I don't mind. No matter what happens, I don't
mind. Yeah, thinking about hard times, these times that we're in, and I mean, in a way, it's always hard times, right? It's always hard times somewhere. But it does seem that there are times in history when things heat up and it becomes more and more aware. We become more and more aware of it. And, you know, you're talking about the time that the Buddha lived in being one of those times. And that's really true. If you think back, it's really true for all of the great wisdom teachers, you know, Moses, Christ, Muhammad, or in more modern times, Thich Nhat Hanh, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, all of them were dealing with these times when things really heat up. And I've often wondered, is there something about these times that draws forth this kind of wisdom in people who are ready for it, you know?
Wow. Wow. So can I deconstruct this with you, Judith?
Sure.
So I was listening to a Rinpoche, well, I forget his name, Tibetan, and he talked about the individual karma, the collective karma. Mm-hmm. So the individual karma is my own causes and conditions. And you could say the same at the collective level.
Right.
So collectively, all 8 billion of us are the reason why the world is the way it is today. Mm-hmm. So how did the world become this way? Because of us. Because if I'm not at peace with you, how can I talk about world peace? If I'm not at peace with myself, I haven't embodied that in me. How do I talk about world peace? Because the wars are based on people not being at peace with each other, whether it's based on special interest or policy interest or resource interest. It's fundamentally the same thing. So then when I look at myself and I say, okay, if these conditions are not peaceful, how am I contributing to that? Mm-hmm. You know, have I forgiven those who hurt me? Have I asked for forgiveness, even if not physically, energetically, for those that I hurt? Did I say sorry when I needed to say sorry? Or did my ego take over? Did I acknowledge where I may have some morality issues and want to do better next time? And if I'm doing that, and you're doing that, and all 26 of us here are doing it, and all 26 of us, or 26 plus of us, are connected to at least one more person. So if we reflect that they do it too, that's the new earth. That's the new paradigm. Mm-hmm. But we are where we are today because we've all become hateful and scared, which is why I was compelled to read the lyrics from the song by Bob Marley.
Right. Well, in thinking also even of the way we respond to the injustice and all of the outrageous stuff that's coming at us all the time. And I know when in the 60s and 70s, when I was demonstrating and I was in Selma and I was in Washington, D.C. and everything, and I was so angry. And that's what motivated me, because I was so angry. And then at some point in time, it occurred to me, angry people can't bring peace to the world. So how do I respond now, you know, because I'm out on the streets again from time to time.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And
you know, you're right. Yesterday I was watching something on Bangladesh, on Sheikh Hasina, who's been the former leader, who's been sentenced to death because of the issues there. And the symbol for the unrest in Bangladesh was of this student leader who spread his arms like this and got shot. Mm-hmm. You know that. So that outstretched arm, him like this. I think, to me, from what I know, the kind of anger that's useful is righteous indignation.
Right, yeah. But how do you tell the difference? It's so easy.
You do no harm.
Yeah, yeah.
You do no harm to me or you. Mm-hmm. To the person who hurt me. Because I know the person who's hurting me, if they knew that to hurt me, they would have to hurt themselves first, wouldn't hurt me. Mm-hmm. So with that basic knowledge, I know they are ignorant. How do you treat an ignorant person? With anger? You become ignorant too.
Right.
Then I'm not saying you don't acknowledge that this person wants to chop off my head. I see that. Mm-hmm. But I have no problem losing my leg. That's why I went on the walk of peace. I had a beautiful two legs, and I was a handsome monk. And just right into it, because I'm doing this with greater humility, I had to lose my leg. No problem. I'm talking about one of the monks from the Walk of Peace. Mm-hmm. You see, so that's the courage of the Dharma. That student in Bangladesh, Dhaka, who went like this. You know, why did Thich Nhat Hanh meet Martin Luther King? Because he was fighting in his home country. He became a pariah there. But how was he fighting? With love.
Love, yeah.
Not ignorance, not bypassing. Mm-hmm. You hear those monks speak on the walk for peace.
Right.
And they're talking about the practice that you and I have. They're not making political speeches. Why are people following them everywhere? So when there's peak hate, there's an opportunity for peak love.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm not Pollyanna-ish. I'm not. If I was, I'd still be married to my second wife. So I don't know. It's a deconstruction. I don't know, Judith. What do you think?
Well, I think that there is a difference in saying, okay, this is not okay. What's being done is not okay. Hurting these people, it's not okay. And I'm going to stand up for a different way. And I think what I keep running into is people who want bad things to happen to the people who are perpetrating these injustices. because they're so angry. And that seems to me to be the line that you don't cross.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. I'll give one more example. So in apartheid South Africa, who were the recipients of brutality? The black South Africans. Well, apartheid ended in 94, and now Zimbabwe was crumbling. So you have these Zim folks who are going to South Africa to work. Now they speak Zulu and Hosa, so they're pretty much the same people. Guess who are the meanest and most inhumane to the Zimbabweans? The black South Africans, mm-hmm. who are now immigration folks and police. Why? Because the colonizer becomes the colonized, and it goes on and on and on.
Right.
And until you've dealt with your own shadows, you're bypassing. And that's why the cycle of suffering continues until we get tired of the cycle of suffering. We become disenchanted with the passion of suffering, so we become dispassionate about suffering, mm-hmm. is what I'm hearing you point to. So
yeah.
Nothing wrong with people on the streets, but if you're making fun of people and calling them names, you're no different. You're
right.
At the same frequency. Same frequency. It's not a hierarchy of good and evil. It's a continuum. Low frequency, high frequency. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Nona.
Thank you.
Great speech.
Thank you. Thank you. Maybe one more Candace, please.
I'll be quick. A lot of this conversation has reminded me of a koan that I've been working with. There is nothing I dislike. That is quite a challenge to work with in these times. And yet, whenever I ask myself, okay, in this moment, can I say there is nothing I dislike? I can. Because it is what is happening. So, you know, I have no opinion. I can protest it. I can say this isn't right. But there is nothing I dislike. Yeah. I think you agree. It's a good one for right now. It's exploding my brain in a good way.
There's nothing I dislike. I think that's that. I think heartbreak, Suze, is a precursor to healing. It's like, how do you know you're happy? How do you know you have joy? There was a previous state that makes the new state possible. Just like, how do you know there's light? Darkness existed before. You're right. There's nothing I dislike. There's nothing I dislike. That's the ultimate statement on Persian hate. Not bypassing. Not I accept. Not... I shouldn't add anything more. I think the statement stands on its own. The poem stands on its own. There's nothing in this line. And please remain on mute. We'll be on a chance to come back. I don't know what else to say, Candace. There's nothing I dislike. That's really it. So I want to thank you for your time, your energy, and your attention.